Peter Greenberg. Doesn't that sound like a fun trip?
It does. I've been to Wales many times, and I'm jealous.
Yeah, no kidding. I so want to see Stonehenge. I'm already ready to be disappointed, but it's just one of those things I remember looking at as a kid in my history and social studies book, and I thought, how fascinating. I want to go there, so I'm going to go there. You been to Stonehenge before, Peter?
I have, and I didn't knock any of them down.
Yeah, I know. That's almost tempting. A couple of things. First of all, Icon of the Seas is this mammoth new ship. They say it's the largest cruise ship in the world with almost 6,000 passengers and close to 3,000 crew. I've seen pictures of it, and I don't want to get on that ship, but I guess a lot of people do. What do you know or think about that ship, Peter?
Well, I used to joke that some of these larger cruise ships are so big they've got high crime areas on board. That was a joke, but Let's put this in perspective. What they've done at Royal Caribbean is they've decided that some of these ships, it doesn't matter where they're going, the ships themselves have become the destination.
Yeah.
With so many different things to do. And then they worked with the human engineers and with space and flow and management to make sure that as large as the ships are and as how many passengers they have, you're never going to stand in line. You're never going to feel crowded. You're always going to have space. And they've mastered the art, and I should say the science, of getting people on and off the ship quickly so that, you know, because the fear always was by the time you got to a port, by the time you got off the ship, it was time to get back on again. they figured that out. I wish the airlines could figure that out in terms of crowding planes and getting people off. But in this situation, you got to hand it to RCCL. If you want to have a ship with that many bells and whistles, you have to figure out flow and efficiency, and they've done that.
RCCL, Royal Caribbean, you mean?
Yes.
And, yeah, I suppose that looks like heaven to some people and hell to others. But, I mean, you know, it's kind of in those gaudy light pinks and oranges and yellows and blues and reds. You know, it looks like something in Mexico or Orlando, the top of the boat. And I suppose if I was 12 years old, I would never want to get off that ship. And if I was the parent of that kid, maybe that's perfect, right?
Well, interestingly enough, what cruise lines like Royal Caribbean have done is they've given kids and parents sort of like homing beepers, sort of like their own Apple AirTags, so the parents always know where the kids are, and the kids always know where the parents are,
wow.
Because that's how big the ship is.
The thing has 40 bars and restaurants. It has 8 swimming pools or water features.
It does. The one thing they don't have, thank God, is a tattoo parlor. because you know, Virgin Cruises has that, and my performance of what the morning after must look like on that cruise is a guy rolling up his sleeves and going, "Who's Betty?" anyway.
One last thing about all of this, and then I want to talk to you about airplane doors, but the rooms start at $1,500 and go up to maybe $3,400 per person for a week. I've cruised a lot, and those are not so high that most folks couldn't do it. I thought those prices sounded reasonable. What do you think?
They're not unreasonable, but you have to put that in perspective. That's just the base price of your cabin. There are so many different things on the ship that run as profit centers and revenue generators.
Oh.
So you have to budget that into your cruise, or you're going to have some sticker shock. Remember, it's your choice. You don't have to do any of those things and still pay $1,500 for the cabin and get 3 meals a day. But, of course, there are so many different entertainment opportunities and just activities that you might want to do. Just plan to budget accordingly.
Well, that's to me, that's not a vacation. That is, that's why I like the all-inclusive but more expensive trips that we take on Regent and so forth, where once you're on the ship, it's all the liquor you want, top shelf, all the activity you want, the excursions, the transfers, it's all paid for. You don't even tip. You can't tip. You could if you
exactly.
want to leave a little money in an envelope at the end, but that's not even necessary.
I just came off a ship, brand new ship. It was its inaugural cruise, the Silver Sea Silver Nova.
Oh, yeah.
That's part of Royal Caribbean as well. And that is all inclusive at the luxury level. I mean, no cabins, but suites. No inside cabins. Everybody has balconies and butlers. So now, was I on for 2 weeks being spoiled? No, I was on for 2 days working, but I'm not going to complain.
I think I said Royal Caribbean Well, you said Royal Caribbean, Regent Seven Seas, the Splendor, the Navigator, some of those ships are the ones we've traveled on, and we're big fans of those. What are we to make of what happened with that airplane over Alaska?
Well, we don't have enough time right now to talk about it, but I will tell you this. This investigation is going to continue. Those planes are not going to fly for quite some time because it goes back to not proper oversight and inspection on the assembly line, not proper oversight and inspection by the FAA, which is understaffed and underbudgeted. Because as you know, and you probably already reported, the two carriers that operate these particular planes, Alaska and United, have already reported upon their inspections. Mm-hmm. They found missing or loose bolts in that assembly. This is not a good thing on a pressurized plane. We just saw it happened to the Alaska Airlines plane, and they were very lucky that it happened at only 16,000 feet. If it had happened at cruising altitude, you and I would be having a much different conversation. So the answer right now is there are 171 planes that may not be flying for a while.
What would this conversation be like were it at 30,000 feet?
We would be going to a lot of funerals.
Seriously?
Absolutely. That plane would have completely disintegrated at that altitude because the pressure differentials are just too great. No different than what happened to the submarine when it was at the depths when it imploded.
I'm sorry, but let me just talk to me about that. So it pops out. There's a lot of pressure on the inside of the plane, less on the outside. So all the paper and anything that's not tied down goes swooshing out the door, including maybe people. But if I were buckled in, I would survive that, wouldn't I?
You would survive that as people did on this particular plane at 16,000 feet. But the pressure increases as you gain altitude. And planes don't jets like the 737 don't cruise at 16,000 feet. He was on his climb out of Portland. They cruise at 35,000. And at 35,000 feet, the pressure is so intense that if you lost the structural integrity of the plane, you lose the plane.
I'm sorry, the pressure differential is so great. The pressure on the outside of the plane is very nominal, but it would explode more if that door popped off, in other words.
Well, it would. And so they were very lucky because at 16,000 feet, they could declare an emergency and get down under 10,000 feet as fast as they could, and they did. And we're close enough to turn around and get back to Portland and make a safe emergency landing.
Well, Peter, the thing that is frustrating to me is that this plane was not cleared, if you will, by the airline itself to fly over water because of some pressurization red lights previously. How is it that they explain that to me?
I wish I could. That is one of the great unanswered questions here. Somebody actually looked the other way on this one because when you have warning lights, they're warning lights for a reason.
Yeah.
And you don't look, you may remember there was an Alaska Airlines plane that became the actual basis of the movie that Denzel Washington starred in, where they knew they had a problem with a jack screw on the tail assembly, but they decided they'd fix it when they got around to it. And of course it disintegrated in the air and the plane inverted and went into the Pacific Ocean. Everybody died. The question was asked then, you knew you had a problem. Why didn't you fix it then? And you know what? A warning light, you know, when you're driving your car and the check oil light comes on, do you drive it for another 700 miles? I don't think so. And that's going to have to be addressed as well. But the underlying problem here is the FAA. FAA's relationship with Boeing and the FAA's relationship with the airlines who operate the plane. They're understaffed. They're under budgeted. And who was on that assembly line to make sure the workmanship was done the right way?
Some of us, when our check oil light comes on, do continue to drive the car, but we don't have 250 people in the vehicle at 16,000 feet either. I suspect you're going to talk about this more on Eye on Travel, which Sunday here on WGN Radio will be from 1 to 3. We will hear you here Sunday from 1 to 3, Peter.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for your time and expertise. He's the CBS News travel editor and the host of our Eye on Travel.